It's less about assembling and more about unification, ultimate unify on this episode of
Comics of the Atom.
Welcome back to Comics of the Atom podcast, a series that examines some of the most influential and important comic book series and the people behind those creations. I'm your co-host, Michael Von Green, and with me, as always, in the ultimate lineup, starting position, Captain Carson Woodard. How's it going, man?
Just a bit chilly from being frozen in the ice for all these years, I guess. But how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Okay. I think it's starting. I'm getting a little bit of cabin fever again. I can't believe the summer is almost over. I want this election to happen tomorrow so I don't have to think about it for another 4 years, but it'll arrive here soon enough. So, but excited to sort of travel back in time once again to sort of the early 2000s to talk about Mark Millar's and Brian Hitch's Ultimates, which is, I believe, well, the third main series in the Ultimate Comics lineup by Marvel. I know we had Ultimate Spider-Man and Ultimate X-Men come out before the Ultimates, but really, I wonder, you know, why do the Ultimates is probably what people are asking. Why not do Ultimate Spider-Man or Ultimate X-Men? Well, I think number one, those series go on forever, and I think we probably wouldn't do them. Like, you almost need a separate podcast for Ultimate Spider-Man, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I feel like to do that series justice, like, it's a long haul. Like, that team of Brian Bendis and Mark Bagley, I think they did 111 issues together in a row. So, obviously, there's, like, probably no natural break for a little podcast like us. Whereas the Ultimates has, if we want, depending on how far we want to go, if we just want to do volume one, it's only a nice 13 issues. If we want to even visit volume two, it's the same. I'm not visiting volume three. I'm telling you that now.
Yeah. Maybe that foreshadows some of the quality of the Ultimate Universe as it goes on, as years go on. But I think what's like pretty significant about the Ultimates is how probably important it is to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And there's probably one character in particular that, you know, I don't know if the MCU would be what it is today if Mark Millar hadn't done this to what character, Carson? I'm trying to tee up.
Sam Jackson's mixture. Oh, man, what a combination. It seems like it's the perfect combination now, but back in the 2000s, that's something just like, what? Why? But boy, did he prove us wrong.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think Samuel Jackson was probably at least well-known by then, but not like the juggernaut superstar that he is today. And I looked that up because You know what's interesting, and we'll kind of get into the history here before we talk about the individual issues, but, you know, there was, you know, a phone call that took place after the release of these issues. Samuel Jackson did not, give his, I guess, okay for them to use his likeness in this series, but they worked out a deal that said, hey, you know what, if we do any movies in the future and Nick Fury is in them, you can go ahead and play Nick Fury. How about we do that? So that, I think, worked out brilliantly for everyone. And if were a fan of the Ultimates or you knew about this series and you watched Iron Man and you see him come out in that post-credit sequence and talk about the Avengers Initiative, you're probably like, holy shit. Wow, they're going to do the Ultimate Nick Fury, huh? That's pretty cool. So, yeah, so that's the beginnings, you know, like that's one of the many reasons why I think Ultimates is important probably to the MCU. But let's kind of rewind a bit just so that we kind of understand what the Ultimate Comics lineup is. Carson, can you kind of give like a, maybe for those who don't because the Ultimate Comics line is now gone. There's no more Ultimate Comics, but can you kind of give, you know, the listeners like a good overview of what the Ultimate Comics were?
Yeah, the Ultimates were basically just a nice way for a new reader to come in and read something without decades of continuity. Because at this point, after the 90s, and both companies are kind of guilty of this, in my opinion, where you just had, it was so continuity-based and continuity-heavy, which is rewarding to your main core readers, obviously. Well, for the most part, it depends how good or bad the stories are. At that point in the late 90s, there were a lot of bad stories in comic books. A lot of people, I mean, readers were leaving in droves, and I think the Marvel bankruptcy proved that, or helped prove that, I should say. But wow, like, I just remember even when I was in high school around this point, around, you know, 2000, 2001, 2002, like, it got to the point where I didn't even really care too much about collecting comics anymore, because, I mean, it was a lot of work, and this was before, you know, Wikipedia and the internet and all that stuff, where if you hopped in a book and you had questions, you couldn't just go, like, I mean, they probably had some resources back in the day, but it's not like now where there's tons of resources that you can go do your research and kind of help with that, get caught up. Back in the day, you had like Wizard Magazine, and they kind of talked about how great Gen 13 was. That's nice and all, but you kind of had to take what you could get from there. And sometimes it didn't have all of the information you needed. So when a book like Ultimate Spider-Man came along, and when I started college, you know, in 2002, 2003, I stumbled into a comic shop and I saw Ultimate Spider-Man issue 34 sitting on the shelf. And I kind of started talking to, you know, the guy at Vintage Phoenix here in wonderful Bloomington, Indiana about it. And, you know, he was kind of introducing that whole series as, you know, it's light on continuity, obviously, because, hey, there were only 33 issues of continuity before that. So it's not too hard to do a lot of research there. So it was easy to pick up and read and just kind of dive into, more or less. So I think that was the ultimate, if you will, the ultimate solution for their, you know, their problem with the readers at the time, because I couldn't tell you what was going on with Avengers and such at the time. The only thing I kind of remember from early 2000s Marvel, which there are some good stuff, obviously. Amazing Spider-Man, of course, the John Michael Straczynski run, actually, I thought it was pretty solid. And then Grant Morrison's X-Men, of course, which we've talked tons about that without actually covering it. So,
yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, you nailed it with the approach that they took at Marvel was like, all right, let's introduce this new lineup of comics called Ultimate Whatever, and we'll start with X-Men, and we'll do Spider-Man. And, you know, the Spider-Man run is amazing. I think it's one of my favorite runs in comics. I don't know if anyone will ever be able to do something like that. And I say that and I'm thinking, okay, you know what? Dan Slott kind of, I think, redid, you know, Spider-Man justice again in Amazing Spider-Man in his tenure on that book. So, you know, Spider-Man, I think from probably 2000 to 2015, almost up till 2020, you know, a lot of love there. You can't go wrong. But yeah, I remember the Ultimate comic line coming out, and I remember how big Ultimate Spider-Man was. And you talked about Wizard Magazine, and that issue quickly was like $100. Mm-hmm. There was like probably five or six variant covers, which I guess they just didn't learn their lesson from the bankruptcy of the mid-90s for doing all that. But those went for, you know, an insane amount of price. All that's kind of went back down, but you know, Spider-Man was pretty quote unquote normal. It was a very typical superhero book. The writing, Bendis's writing is amazing in it, and he does a great job of, you know, writing this young Peter Parker growing up and trying to be a hero. Don't want to spend too much time on that, but it's a very easy book to get into. And the X-Men were fun too, because there are like twists, right? You like Jean Grey looked like this punk rocker. You know, Wolverine was this inside man for Magneto's team. So there's these cool twists that they brought, right? And this is after the 2000 X-Men movie, which was a huge hit. So their costumes are more neutralized, like the movie. And then, you know, of course, Spider-Man's going to come out in 2002. So this is sort of the resurgence of, like, Marvel, you know, well before the MCU happens, well before it becomes a juggernaut again in terms of pop culture. It's definitely, you know, we talked last time on Spawn and how many comic books were being sold. We'll never get back to that era of comics, probably. I don't think single issues will ever sell like that again. But No. But this is the rise, re-rise of comic popularity. And, you know, I do, yeah, I remember comics being in such a weird place. I think George Perez was doing The Avengers, and I sort of liked that book, but sort of didn't like that book. I mean, we've talked about George Perez before. He's an amazing, talented artist. I personally just do not like his art style. I don't know why. I think it's maybe just too classic of an art style or something like that. But Bagley, Mark Bagley, in the 90s, I'm sure you had it too, those cards. You know, you had the Spider-Man series cards where it was, you know, 3x3, and you collected all nine. It would create this mural. Spider-Man was, you know, in the middle, or he was in, you know, the left corner of the card. And there was like eight other villains. And I remember me and you, C2E2, that first C2E2 that nobody went to. There's Mark Bagley.
Yep.
Sitting there by himself. Nobody's talking to him. And I went and found, you know, the first appearance of Carnage and got it signed by him. And it was just like, that was an amazing time. So, you know, so it's good to know. I guess what I'm saying is it's good to know your history. So both these books are really popular. Mark Millar is doing X-Men, and Bendis is doing Spider-Man. And both of these writers are sort of building this ultimate universe, which is actually Earth 1610. Not sure where that number comes from, but the regular Marvel universe is 616. And Carson, for all the marbles, do you know where Earth 616 gets its name?
Oh, God. I think I actually looked this up once, but the answer does escape me right this side. Is it the area code? Is it an area code in New York?
No, I think it's... I looked it up. I should have put it in the notes. But it comes out of a Captain Britain storyline where he's on trial, and they refer to the universe that he... or the Earth that he comes from as 616. And that was in, like, 1983 or something like that.
Wow.
So that was the first mention. It was just... I don't... Yeah, I should go back and look that up and give credit to whoever came up with that. But that is now a staple of, you know, Marvel Comics. So, you know, that... another interesting little history side note there. But, yeah, so both those... writers are creating these universes. And what's weird also about the Ultimate Comics lineup is there's also all these offshoots. There's like team-ups, there's like adventures, there's all these... they'll just do random miniseries. And so before Ultimates launches in 2002, and we get reintroduced to the Avengers, who are now going to be called the Ultimates in the Ultimate Universe, you know, the Hulk did show up in a Marvel team up with Spider-Man and Iron Man as well. So I don't know if you remember that. It was kind of weird because they're going to do... what's weird about the Ultimate lineup too, is that they kind of retcon themselves like all the time. And that, like, Marvel team up, like, the Hulk is green. They hadn't decided, like, the Hulk's going to go back to gray. So there's, if you try to go back and be like, okay, well, they're talking about Hulk fighting Spider-Man in the second issue. Well, when did that happen? Did that happen in Ultimate Spider-Man? No, it's an Ultimate team-up, and that is still a little incohesive. I don't know if you remember kind of any of that confusion, but I remember, like, the funny thing is like, hey, let's start these new comics, introduce them to new readers, but you know what? Let's make it super confusing as well.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. And I feel like this, like, the year 2000-ish is when they started to get rid of, like... you remember, like, in the 90s, you'd be reading, like, a comic book, and it'd be like, for this reference, go back to this comic book, and, like, the little
editor
bubbles and stuff. I feel like...
This happened in issue 323.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like this is the era where they kind of just eliminated that whole reference. I guess they just decided that the readers were either going to be smart enough or just not care. I don't know, but this would have been one of those times where, yeah, it's like, this happened in Ultimate Marvel Team-Up, whatever. But yeah, I feel like this is that first time where you're reading the Ultimate stuff and they didn't feel like they needed that for whatever reason. And I also kind of, I was kind of thinking at myself, like, well, wasn't there a Green Hulk appearance first in the Ultimate Universe? And I'm guessing that's why we kind of had that, like, MacGuffin thing of, like, oh, I cured myself of the Hulk, but I have to take this super soldier serum to test it out. So somehow that turns me gray.
Yeah, I guess that's a little bit of a retcon, or I don't know what they're trying. They wrote themselves in the hole, or they're like, maybe we shouldn't have pulled that trigger so early on. It's all
Freddie Prinze Jr.'s fault.
Yeah. We'll definitely get into celebrities here in a bit. But before we get into that first issue, just kind of run down with the two main heavy hitters, and then we'll get into like the ink and the coloring on the next podcast. But, you know, Mark Millar, as I was looking up notes for the podcast, what was really cool was that he actually did an interview with Grant Morrison while Grant Morrison was doing Animal Man for a fanzine that he was working on. So that's a nice little... You know, everything comes back around, right? you know, eventually he did collaborate with Grant Morrison on Swamp Thing. And a lot of these writers that we've have already covered, you know, a lot of them, you know, worked on 2000 AD, it seems like. But the other thing that really gets, like, so he was working at DC before he comes over to Marvel. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, they'll release this in 2003, but he did, I think... It wasn't very clear when I was looking it up, but you know, he also wrote the infamous Superman Red Sun miniseries, which is awesome. You know, that's if Superman was born in the Soviet Union, how would that play out? So I think that's pretty cool. And so people that may not know Millar probably, you know, on a first name basis, probably, you know, recognize some of his other work outside of comics, Kick-Ass, Wanted, Kingsman. So that's his quote unquote Millar world. And Carson, do you know anything about, I believe like he struck some deal with Netflix. Do you ever remember hearing anything about that? Like he's going to create something, a Millar world from Netflix?
Yeah, there's definitely a relationship between Netflix and Millar world. And I don't know if it's like Netflix just feels like using the Millar world imprint to make comics, or if Millar World is making properties for Netflix to eventually use, or a little bit of both. But so far out of the agreement, it seems like it's just Netflix goes really big on the back of a comic book. And I guess if the comic book is a hit, Netflix has the rights to make that into whatever they want, whether it be a movie or a series. I think the first big book that came out of that so far was Magic Order. And Magic Order is actually a pretty solid read, so I recommend that as well if anyone has not checked that out. I think it's prime Millar that, you know, we really haven't seen since the 2000s with a lot of titles you just listed, like Wanted and Kick-Ass, and even his regular 616 Wolverine run was pretty solid, too.
Yeah, he's definitely done a lot of work that's all over the place that... I feel like there's a lot of stuff out there by him, but I don't think his name is very recognizable. So maybe that'll change in the coming years. Who knows? And then another name that, you know, is well known within comic circles, but probably not well known to the public is Brian Hitch, who does these, I think, incredibly fantastic, like highly detailed. He has like illustrations. He has a very realistic aesthetic, I think, and we'll kind of get into that as we go through the Ultimate comic volume one here. The one thing that's always going to stick out in my mind when I think about Ultimates is Hawkeye's hair. If you know what I'm talking about, Carson, I don't want to spoil it, but like the detail that Brian Hitch does on Hawkeye's hair, I guess, quote unquote hair, is kind of like insane. And some of the detail work that we're going to get into in this first issue, I think, is like insane too. Like, and of course, he's no stranger to Miss Deadline. So, like any great artist in the comic book realm, They're just never going to be on time. You're just going to have to, that's just going to be something you're going to have to deal with. So, yeah, with any,
there is not a lot of wasted space on the page. Like this guy, like,
yes.
And his backgrounds are probably almost second to none too. Like maybe with the exception of like a guy like Alex Ross, obviously, but in the world of comics, sometimes the backgrounds or faces of faraway characters get obscured or, you know, not really drawn at all, but Brian Hitch puts details into almost every single frame of a comic book, which that's why I think he's perfect for the Ultimates. I feel like the Ultimates was almost designed to be like, here's your prototype movie script, guys. Like, do what you need to do with it. And bring in Brian Hitch adds that, like, cinematic flair for sure to this whole run.
Absolutely. His previous work, too, JSA with Mark Waid, and then I've never read it, but I need to, now that we've kind of gone through this, it's just like 2000 AD, it keeps coming up, and it's just stuff that I've never gotten around to reading, but Warren Ellis's Authority, he's done a ton of work on that too, so you know, that was what he was bringing to the table. I think he's a much older, like, artist too by this point. I think Mark, I don't know. I'm not sure. Eh, we don't need to get into how old or young they are. But yeah, and then he's pretty responsible for the modernization of like the costumes that you see with the Ultimates and eventually Ultimate Fantastic Four. But yeah, let's get into it. You know, Superhuman, number one, Ultimates, which is a Captain America focused issue. So they start it right off the bat with World War II Captain America. And I'm glad you brought up that singular word cinematic, because I think the opening pages of this book, actually every single page in this first issue just feels insanely cinematic, right? It's teasing Captain America. He's in the back of the plane. You don't really get a full view of him. It has this beautiful coloring of these red and greens because let me back up a little again. This is like origin story Captain America, World War II. They're in a plane. They're flying somewhere, right, to confront Nazis. And so there's a little bit of mysticism going on too. Like the crew isn't really buying into the Captain America legacy. Like he's already almost like a fable during this time period. So, but yeah, Carson, you talk about the details, not wasted space. I mean, there's like, you know, if you go to like page 7, there's like all these parachutes. How many parachutes do you think are in these panels that are raining down on this Nazi encampment?
Oh yeah, there's definitely like that's what caught my eye too, is just the amount of parachutes in the background. But speaking of this first issue, like I just remember going and seeing the Captain America movie in theaters, and I was just like lukewarm to it because like, man, I just feel like I've seen this exact story somewhere, and it just felt like I'd already seen the movie before I went and saw it in theaters, obviously. And I'm thinking this issue is the main reason why. Like it's just an interesting way to start an entire series too. Like with the success of Spider-Man and X-Men, there were a ton of eyes on this series. So when this thing came out and it only had a Captain America focused issue to start, I was a little bit surprised by that, to be honest. Like I'm still kind of tied on if this was a great decision, you know, cause they're telling it, you know, in the sequence of events that took place. So obviously you'd start with Captain America in 45, but yeah, it's just like, where's Thor and Iron Man and so on and so forth. We don't even really see Nick Fury until the beginning of issue 2.
Right. And, yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Captain America movie, because I think what's sort of important about this Ultimate series is not just, you know, that stuff we mentioned about Sam Jackson, but it is like sort of the modernization and the retelling of these stories that laid like a blueprint for the MCU to follow. They don't follow it to a T. You know, they interpret it and do their own things, which I think, you know, as we go along in the series is like rightfully so. I don't think some of the stuff that they do in this book is going to play well with a general audience, but yeah, it's just more about that modernization. And I think too, what's also important during this time period in 2000s, like in terms of Marvel properties, like X-Men and Spider-Man are the biggest, and they've been the biggest for forever. You know, Captain America, Iron Man, even Thor, right, are sort of almost, you know, lower tiered characters. Like, nobody really cares about them too much outside of, like, you know, hardcore comic nerds. Do you feel that way? Like, I remember, you know, really liking, there was, I think it was Mark Waid was doing Captain America in late 90s or early 2000, and I really liked, I was starting to really like that, but I just didn't, like, I knew about Captain America, I just didn't care. Because I had Spider-Man and X-Men and Batman. Who else do I need?
I mean, I think it's pretty telling to your point. I think it's just in the name, honestly. They felt like they didn't even need to call this book The Avengers. They called it The Ultimates.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, you think about, I mean, obviously, Ultimate Comics, Ultimate, blah, 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 but, like, yeah, like, why, the Avengers name didn't mean anything. No one cared about The Avengers. There's a historical legacy that people cared about, but in terms of these characters, that group, you know, not until, you know, Bendis comes around and does Disassembled, which is, like, still a few years away, you know, that no one really, I don't think, cared about these characters that series all that much. But yeah, let's get back into the panels. Yeah, just looking at this stuff again, I got my iPad here, and I am, like, now that we've talked about the detail of Brian Hitch's work, it's just like, even after that parachute panel, you get that full spread of soldiers, you know, rushing the beach or rushing the complex. And so, you know, there's just not a lot of dialogue. The character that we have with us, Captain America, is not saying anything. It's just, you know, Bucky Barnes, who's kind of narrating our journey here, right? He's been with Captain on a lot of missions. I don't even think he's really referred to as Bucky. He's just referred to as Barnes, and he's sort of a medical photography type, role. So all these people are getting shot, and the soldier's like, you know, where's Captain America? And speaking of cinematic, what is Captain America doing, Carson?
Yeah, I'm just going through the opening panels myself. I think there's, like, one dude who calls him Bucky, just so you know, like, who this character is. But of course, see, Captain America has to be, like, the ultimate badass. Like, he doesn't need parachutes, so... My only disappointment is I wanted to see him fall out of the freaking plane. They kind of just, like, cut to the, you know, the soldiers, and then later he hijacks that plane, of course. I mean, it's pretty much exactly like that scene they took from the movie at the end where, you know, Red Skull has, like, that plane or bomb or whatever. Like I said, I've probably even really seen that more than twice because, hey, we got the Ultimates. I can read this. But it's like, almost identical to what's going on there, you know. Instead of him talking to Peggy Carter in the movie, he's talking to Bucky, basically, as his last words. So, yeah, they cram so much into these first 24 issues. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, the detail alone is just staggering, if you want to kind of compare it to other books. Yeah, it's this amazing sequence. He crashes the plane, sort of does like a barrel roll to land on the ground. It's always in my mind, that's not what's drawn. Well, I guess it is. Yeah, he's sort of like doing that as he's coming down into the ground. But then, yeah, we get this beautiful one-shot panel, one full splash page. You know, what are you waiting for, ladies? Christmas? You know, just this epic, you know, super high testosterone, you know, American symbol. So it's pretty gorgeous looking. It's really cool. and so, yeah, they rush to the compound. And as you're, yeah, right, Carson, this is almost like kind of a beat for beat what's, you know, happening in that first movie, right? There's a rocket getting launched. And so he's going to try to save the day because that's what he does as Captain America. And of course, what happens? Well, before that happens, I thought that this was like a funny little inside joke that they did in one of the panels. Is like one of the soldiers in German, which I'm going to butcher horribly because I don't speak German, is like, "Sit, don't open am Himmel," which translates to oh man, the classic Superman line. Where is it? Because I don't want to screw this up, but like, you know, look up in the sky. What is it? Look up in the sky, right? The Superman, classic Superman reference. Hey, it's not a bird. It's not a look up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. I didn't know that. Yeah.
At all, so I have no clue.
Yeah. Well, I was like, I was like, what is that? I wonder what he's saying right there. So I just did a quick Google Translate, and I was like, oh, that's a funny nod. So that's a funny thing. But yeah, I mean, we're like kind of skipping over a bunch. There's a lot of pages. I think there's like what 24 pages, 26 pages. And so what happens, right? Of course we know what happens, Carson.
Yeah, so there's a new kid into the White House. Steve grabs a plane, hops out of the plane onto the nuke, has a grenade, and Bucky's like, what are you doing? Don't be an idiot, Steve. And then grenade blows up, nuke blows up in the sky. They presume that Cap is dead, whereas luckily he landed in the water and he's going to get frozen. So I think the ultimate twist here, though, was Bucky lived through World War II.
Yeah. That's, we'll get to
like
it.
One of the biggest like canon changes from the regular to the ultimate, which I thought was super interesting going forward. That kind of didn't really hit me until I read it, you know, for this podcast. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Bucky didn't die.
Right. Yeah. That's what the ultimate comics were all about, right? Like scratching that familiar itch, but also trying to introduce new twists on the canon. Just to make it exciting, just to make it different. And I think up until this series, like, they kind of played it safe. I mean, Spider-Man is pretty safe. There's nothing too outlandish about that. X-Men's pretty fun with what they do, like I said earlier. But then, you know, as the Ultimates are kind of go on here, I mean, they definitely take some big swings that I think you're just not expecting. And then speaking about leaving putting all the detail on the page, you know, Brian Hitch has this wonderful Mount Everest shot. So the book actually ends with a silhouette of a man looking over Mount Everest. And of course that man is.
It's gotta be Tony Stark and his nice Oakley snow goggles.
Yeah. So he's talking to Happy, which I don't, you know, maybe Carson, Happy as a character, right, plays much more in the MCU than I feel like I ever read in the comics. I don't know I feel like the Ultimates kind of like make him an established character that they can bring into the movie, but I don't ever really mean, he's like, even to this day, he's not really a character.
Right, I agree with that. I mean, I haven't read a ton of older Iron Man comics, especially. I've never been a big Iron Man guy. But yeah, you figured, like, going forward after Jon Favreau, obviously he had the hit with Iron Man and played Happy Hogan in that, you figure they would have shoehorned him in there a little bit more, but I can't think of too many instances where I'm like, oh yeah, Happy Hogan's in this comic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just interesting to see him there on the last couple pages. And he doesn't really play a huge role either in the Ultimates. So it's just, I feel like they read this book and they're like, oh yeah, Jon Favreau, I'm directing this movie. I can play this character. That's easy. And to kind of just reemphasize again, Iron Man, is at this point like not even a B-level character. He is like C-level, I think, character in the Marvel universe. If I think we were being brutally honest, it's not like Iron Man is doing incredibly well. So, but he's a classic Avenger, and that's why he is in the Ultimates. All right, so issue 2 opens up to the damage to pier in New York City, Navy Pier. The Hulk did. They're overlooking that. So now we're introduced to Sam Jackson, aka Nick Fury, and Bruce Banner, and they're having a conversation about the Ultimates team and S.H.I.E.L.D. So this is also like a really important issue because it helps, I think, build the foundation where like S.H.I.E.L.D. wasn't really a big part of like the Marvel universe. I mean, Nick Fury has been around. S.H.I.E.L.D. of course been around, just like the Avengers, been around. But the way that the MCU has relied as on S.H.I.E.L.D. as sort of this backbone, I would say begins here with the Ultimates, right, Carson? I don't think you have that without the Ultimates comic.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. When I think of, like, the 616 Avengers, I think of them hanging out in Avengers Mansion and that stuff. And,
yeah,
you know, Jarvis kind of having to clean up after him. Where here, it feels like a... The Ultimates feel like a very corporate being, basically, between this whatever backing that S.H.I.E.L.D. has with Nick Fury, and he kind of goes into details here, just talking to Banner about the amount of power he has and the amount of people that have to constantly watch what he's doing and surveil him and all that stuff. Like I said, it feels very corporate, especially once you involve Tony Stark and Stark Industries and, you know, how much money he has combined with the power of S.H.I.E.L.D. It kind of reminds me also of the post-80s Justice League with Maxwell Lord funding this version of his Justice League and all that stuff. So I don't know if they stole a little bit from that, but obviously we have higher list characters here being used than the Detroit-era Justice League.
Yeah, and I think you nailed it with, like, the corporate analysis. It's more about the government control. I think it's important to recognize that what this series is also going to do is not only, like, quote unquote, modernize these characters and these stories, but it's also going to place them in the real world. Like, this is 2002. They make that very well known in that Mount Everest shot in the last issue. And America is in a much different place. We're a year out, maybe less than that from 9/11. So you kind of have to think, you know, what is somebody like Nick Fury thinking about? You know, not only do the Avengers have to think about these super being external threats, but like these foreign threats. And I think you'll kind of see more and more of that. I'm going to put it in the show notes, but I found this great article written by Abraham Reisman on vulture.com, you know, talked about the quote unquote, the uncomfortable brilliance of Marvel's The Ultimates, and kind of goes through sort of just rereading this book. And Carson, me and you even talked about it right before this podcast. It's like, I don't really know how to feel about this book. Kind of going back and revisiting it, I think for a third or a fourth time, and sort of like, you know, how the world has changed. And, it's a real interesting comic when you kind of put it in the lens of like what is going through America at this time, and, you know, how this has affected like the MCU and, sort of, I wouldn't say it has aged poorly. I'm definitely not saying that, but I think there's, like, you can't look through it with rosy glasses, rosy tinted, whatever that phrase is, right? Like how we've done the other series. I think we've really celebrated the other works. This is kind of sort of has a different level of respect or a little, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think as we go on with our reviews for the next couple of issues, we're going to find, like, the pacing is just kind of strange to me throughout these first five issues, where usually, like, in an arc, or if you go by a trade of any comic, you know, there's like the build up of what's going on in the first issue, and then they'll leave you on a cliffhanger that makes you want to get the next couple, and then you'll eventually hit that climax in either the last issue or the next to last issue, and then usually there's like a fallout issue. Typically here starts with the origin of Captain America, and then for the next three issues are basically just building the team and interacting with each other is literally all they do. But somehow, like, the quality of the art and the good dialogue between the characters make you actually kind of want to keep reading.
Yeah, the dialogue definitely carries this book, and as well as, like, Brian Hitch's beautiful art. I think, like, if you think about a typical comic book, especially when they're starting a new arc, right, it's like all this, like, sort of, you know, text flavoring, like build up to, you know, here's the characters, this is, you know, the team, or this is the main focus. And then sort of in that first issue on the last panel or so, or maybe the last couple pages, they like introduce the quote unquote threat, right? Like, who's the villain? What's the main thing that's going to drive this narrative? And the main narrative that's driving this book is, like you said, like, oh, who are the new characters that are going to introduce this issue? How are they going to, you know, introduce Giant Man and the Wasp? How are they going to introduce Tony? How are they going to come together as a team? And so those are the things that you start to look forward to. If you're an older reader, as someone who's probably never read comic books before, I would love to get that point of view of, like, I've never read comic books. I don't understand. I don't know who Captain America is. Like, what is going on in this series? I think it could be super interesting to get that perspective. But let's knock out this issue. I think what I really liked after rereading this is how they treat Bruce Banner. You may feel differently, but Bruce Banner is kind of a piece of shit. And if anything, I think probably that a lot of them are, you know, borderline assholes or jerks. But I think what I like about how they position Bruce Banner, who has had the Hulk incident, they've hired him to try to figure out the super soldier serum. He's failed at doing that. He's going to be demoted to number two. Hank Pym is going to be number one. And that really rubs him the wrong way. But he's sort of swarmy. You can kind of see why, like, he lets the Hulk take over, because he's just such a low self-esteem, like, oh, why me? Like a whiny little, like, self-indulged prick. How do you feel about that, Carson?
Yeah, like, immediately from him ordering a roast at this restaurant with, like, every detail possible, and then seeing Sam Jackson just order a steak, like, you know, at this point, like, oh God, this is not a likable character at all, to the point where, like, do you even really feel bad later down the line when, you know, they're doing their own casting call and they're making fun of Banner, and it's like, yeah, I could see Steve Buscemi being Bruce Banner in this one. But yeah, I just wanted to see eventually him and Betty Ross, like, going out on a date, because they seem like they're polar opposites in this. And I have, like, that's probably the most unbelievable thing about this book, is the fact that Betty Ross and Bruce Banner would actually be a couple, because anytime they interact, you're just like, it's just almost like it'd be like nails on a chalkboard actually hearing them talk, I think.
Yeah. Bruce Banner has no self-esteem, no confidence. Like, Betty Ross just runs all over him. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, you can kind of see maybe it's just a power dynamic in their relationship. And speaking of power dynamics, thanks for teeing me up like that. Now we've got Hank Pym and the Wasp are introduced. I think it's probably bad to say this, the twist, it's not a twist, but, you know, they do make Janet of Asian descent. So, you know, at least we get, you know, a marginalized voice on the team this time around. Not everybody is white. So, you know, that's cool. So Giant Man is the focus, right? Just like the original Avengers. But you do see Hank toying around with the Ant-Man helmet, you know, and they're packing up because they're getting called into S.H.I.E.L.D. to be part of this team. So you're introduced to them. So we've got Bruce Banner, Giant Man, Wasp, and then we're introduced to Iron Man. And Carson, I would love to know what you think about the Iron Man design, the suit design. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, I respect him for trying something different. Obviously, it's kind of hard to mess with the actual, you know, 616 Iron Man design, because at this point, that one's pretty iconic, in my opinion. So they tried something different. And I mean, it was okay. I don't know how I feel about him, like, swimming in green goop on the inside of the costume. That was a little weird, but yeah, I didn't mind it for the most part.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting take. I just don't think it lands. It's a nice attempt. It just doesn't, like, it goes too far. It just feels clunky. It doesn't feel like an organic, like, how does he even maneuver around in that thing? I have no idea. So I would say, if anything, like, that's one of the least things I like about, you know, sort of the character designs. Everything else is fine. Everything is, you know, sort of in that vein with the take of Ultimate X-Men, like, let's kind of neutralize the costumes. Let's not make them so flashy. You know, thankfully, oh man, thankfully they did not do that in the movies. I think I would have been super disappointed,
right,
if they tried to do that. They tried to do that early on with all the different Marvel properties. It's mm-hmm. like, nope, let's get these characters to look like these characters. So we're introduced to Iron Man and sort of, you know, him and Nick Fury have a long conversation and kind of tying it back to like, hey, this is definitely 2002. You know, Tony mentions that he needs to go on a date, you know, with Cameron Diaz. you're also, like you mentioned before, we get introduced to Betty Ross. And so we get to see a little bit of that dynamic. And we discover that Janet and Betty were roommates at one point. So that was kind of cool. You know, this sort of starts to wrap up. The Giant Man experiment takes place. You get to see a little bit of, I think, Hank Pym's whimsical personality. Maybe that's not the right word, but he's not as serious as Bruce Banner, right? He's a brilliant scientist. They're all brilliant scientists. But you know, he doesn't take himself so seriously, and he toys with the scientists a little bit. And how does he do that, Carson?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, he kind of reminds me of a slightly more sober Tony Stark throughout the beginning of this, where he's always just, like, messing with Janet and stuff. And you see that scene where they're testing out, you know, if we can be 60 feet for the first time. And off-panel, you see him talking, and he's just like, oh, I'm turning inside out, and they're all panicking, and he's just like, gotcha, and he's like almost 15, whatever the maximum size is, minus 1 inch is what he is in that scene, basically. So, yeah, I'd usually think he's pretty cool, but then eventually in issue 6, which I don't know, we could talk about that next time, totally makes him unlikable throughout the rest of the series.
Yeah, Celebration is cut a little short.
Yeah.
Reality really sets in that issue. What I love about this scene, which I think is like really brilliant and why, you know, I was pretty harsh on the Bruce Banner personality, but actually I really like why they do that. I think it plays incredibly well of like why the Hulk exists, why he's so angry, why he is the way he is. But you get this, you know, they're celebrating the fact that Hank Pym was able to do this. And, you know, you get this flash of the Hulk in Bruce Banner's mind. And it's really well drawn. It's got almost like this blur. It's a really cool short 2 panels. But yeah, it's just like he says, yeehaw. And he's not happy. He's really upset. He's really, really angry. Because he just knows that he's just been sort of forgotten and demoted and he can't just do anything right. So, but he gets sort of a free ticket here at the end. You know, we're circling now back to Captain America and they found him in the ice. And so, hey, Nick Fury calls him up and is like, guess what, Bruce, you know, we got your golden ticket here. So, you know, let's get this super soldier serum cracked. And that ends issue 2. And now we're going to go to issue 3, 21st Century Boy. I love the titles of these comics, by the way, like these single issues. Like, I think the next one is, you know, spoiler alert, Hulk Does Manhattan. But oh my God. Yeah. We get this, crotch shot of Giant Man as the first opening, page of this issue. So him and Janet are out, you know, testing, you know, his new abilities. So that's happening. But yeah, so, and then, you know, they're trying to get Captain America woken up and Carson, speaking of movies, what happens now as they're reviving Captain America?
So yeah, as they're reviving Captain America, like, like the first people there are Stark, Banner and Nick Fury, and they're telling them all about, you know, what's going on, and of course he doesn't believe. But I like how at least Nick Fury, it shows how smart he is. He's already got armed guards there before he even wakes up, and they're like, yeah, it's been 57 years, Captain. And then you just cut to like I said, it's very cinematic. You cut to the hallway, and then a soldier goes through the door, and Cap has already taken out like every soldier in that room. Mm-hmm. And then he immediately launches himself out a window. And yeah, this is pretty much exactly from the movies as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that teaser, well, or mid credits, whatever they call it. Yeah, where he runs out into Times Square, which I'm sure everyone's familiar with, but he doesn't get far. Hank's there to lay his hand down and crushes him into the Jeep. I think that's kind of a funny panel. So he's woken up, and you know, like you said, one of the twists here is that Bucky is actually alive, and the other twist is that Bucky does what?
He marries his sweetheart from the 40s, because that's what live Bucky would do, I guess. So I thought it was kind of weird, like there's no Peggy Carter here. It's a character named, what is it, like Gail Richards, I think.
Gail Richards, yeah.
Which
yeah.
I was like, huh.
I was wondering about that name.
Yeah, I didn't know if it was going to be like Reed Richards' grandma or something, but apparently not. It's just like based on the family tree they described that her and Bucky had together, there's none of that at all. So I just thought that was kind of random.
Yeah, yeah. It's just one of those things where it's like they don't need to go that far
right.
with anything, and or maybe they feel like it's just. That's not the story that they're trying to tell here. So,
yeah, they're just trying to nail down that Cap is out of time, basically, which is
right.
definitely a theme. Yeah. Like after, maybe it was after this story, or maybe there's another story. I'm sure there's been plenty where, you know, Cap being alive now is missing 1940s America and all of his friends and family, basically. But yeah, they're just doing a good job here nailing down the fact that like how lonely he must be.
Yeah, and you know, does he belong in this world? What can he do, right? And that's going to motivate him to show up and be Captain America again. But you know, as we're going through the pages, and another important milestone with this series that becomes a permanent fixture, not in the MCU. Well, I say quote unquote permanent fixture, very quickly goes away. But like especially in the comics, in the new Avengers that'll come out here in a couple years, the Triskelion, the S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, maximum security prison is introduced here for the first time in Marvel Comics, and right, and that becomes a fixture, like I just said, in the main Marvel universe. It's the reason why the new Avengers will actually form together. Here in a couple years, but obviously that was a main focus in Winter Soldier. So, you know, that's pretty cool, right? So there's just a ton of stuff, you know, being lifted here. You know, and going back and talking about 9/11, now they're at this party kind of celebrating the success of bringing Captain America back, you know, getting the Giant Man formula, you know, these Ultimates, you know, actually becoming a team. So they're having this gala, and, yeah, the unfortunate President George Bush shows up, and the comic ends with him asking Nick Fury, "Well, what's your verdict on the 21st century Captain America? Cool or uncool?" And then it ends on the last page, full once again, mimicking sort of that, you know, that splash page that was in that first comic when he was yelling about Christmas. He says, "Cool, Mr. President. Definitely cool." I don't know if it's cool.
I feel like he's just lying to himself at this point, especially like if you George Bush Jr. say asking you if something is cool, like first off, like that's probably not like this was like two old men using like new lingo. Which even later down the line, Janet's just like, you know, when you use the word slacks, you sound like my dad. He's like, well, I'm actually older than your dad, sweetheart.
So it's definitely this weird like and I'm sure that's sort of the point, right? It's like this, you know, America first kind of
right.
before that was even a phrase, like, you know, like especially back then in 2002, right? Mission accomplished, America, blah blah blah. So I think that's the tone that they're trying to hit here. But now we're going to kind of move on to 4 here. Yeah, and so 4 is going to introduce sort of the final member of the team, Thor. This issue's called Thunder. And not only do we have like George Bush showing up, but you open this issue and once again, very 2000s, Elizabeth Shannon, which they must have had to have gotten the likeness rights or something, or, you know, asked permission to use her name and likeness. But Tony is up in space with Elizabeth Shannon, so who is probably riding off the popularity of American Pie still. So that's where we are, folks, in the America, you know, vernacular. So he's doing an interview with Larry King, you know, and, you know, Tony kind of like does this like side swipe, you know, Bruce Banner, right? He says something like, you know, we're sort of disappointed that he wasn't able to crack that formula, but, you know, we have Captain America anyway. And you get a panel of Bruce Banner sulking, and that's going to be really important. And then Carson, you mentioned it just briefly here, but, you know, yeah, like, him and the Wasp, or Captain America and the Wasp, are getting close. But this is kind of a sad scene, don't you think? You know, they're kind of going into this, you know, you get this opening beautiful landscape of New York, like almost like this high rise, like building. And you're like, oh, that's where Captain America lives, but he doesn't live there. What's going on, Carson?
Yeah, so Cap, once again, it's just like his last part of denial. He just wants to live where he was raised, basically. Unfortunately, that has kind of been overran by gangs and thugs and that stuff, to the point where, like, he's barely even moved in, and he's already been broken into. So yeah. You can just tell, like, the second you see his, like, apartment, there's graffiti all over the walls, and there's, like, the crack, like, well, with all that Ultimates money, can't you pay for something better? And he's just like, $600 is way too much for a single bedroom apartment. Boy, yeah, he is instantly wrong. So whatever he's already tried to rebuy from his past is already gone instantly.
Yeah, I think looking at these panels again, there's definitely this aesthetic of, you know, Brian Hitch, you know, you have this glorious view of the New York cityscape. It looks expensive. It looks, you know, like high society. And as sort of the panels are sort of getting closer and closer to Captain America and the Wasp, you know, the streets are starting to deprecate and getting more, you know, run down, broken into, boarded up, graffitied. And it's just like, yeah, sort of this, I think, you know, and then you go inside the interiors of these buildings, which are far worse than the outside. It's just sort of like this macro to micro, you know, I think, view of like the city and sort of like what Captain America came from, right? You know, like everyone in, like, you know, like sort of, right, World War II, you know, like what was that American vision, and, you know, compared to what it is now, I think is like pretty interesting. That's a cool little moment there. You know, Betty then yells at Bruce some more, so makes him feel like a piece of shit as he rightfully so. But Bruce you know, gets in a plane with Nick Fury to go visit the God of Thunder. Now this is you know, an interesting take on the character, because it plays out for a long time. But Carson, how do they kind of introduce Thor?
Yeah, it turns out he's like basically an environmentalist, and he doesn't like politicians. And this is like the most different version of a character, I think, in the whole thing. And not only that, like, there's always this seed of doubt, which grows into a big tree by the time you get to volume 2, where is this guy like just found this like hammer of power and he's lost his mind since then, or is he the actual like son of Thor from Asgard? Like, they really don't clearly answer that question for a very long time. So it's just like they present him as kind of like this crazy environmentalist nutcase, but somehow at the end of the day, he is somehow still Thor.
Yeah, like Bruce says, you're not the new Messiah. You're just a crazy ex-nurse who had a nervous breakdown 3 weeks short of his 13th birthday and spent 18 months in a lunatic asylum. So they play up this like seeds of doubt that you're just so uncertain. Like, is this really Thor? Does he have any powers? What's he gonna do? Like you said, maybe he's just a crazy guy that found this magical hammer. So, you know, like that's kind of one of the cool things about the Ultimate series is playing with those expectations. But at the same time, it goes down roads where it's just like, okay, that's cool, but do I really want to read a book where Thor is potentially just a crazy person and not a hero, right? Like, I don't know if I want to read that story. And I think that's sort of, you know, like I think the Ultimates in a nutshell, to some degree, is like, okay, cool, there's some big swings, but man, at the end of the day, like, I don't really feel good about any of these people.
Yeah, I mean, out of all the new presentations of the characters, I would probably say, I don't know, I find Thor the most intriguing of the bunch. And then maybe even kind of Banner too, even though like he kind of sucks from a, you know, a character style standpoint. Just like, that's kind of the perfect setup for Hulk though, obviously, because so far here in issue 4, it is just raining shit on Bruce Banner. Like, not only does he doubt himself, Betty is dating a different person in like every issue. The media is now like talking about how he can't replicate the super soldier serum, and they're doubting him. So you have Banner who can't figure anything out. And then you have this crazy guy, Thor, which, yeah, for some reason they still want him on the team though, which I think that's kind of the funniest thing, is like, how can you trust this guy?
Right. And speaking of Banner, he decides that he's going to, when we talked about earlier, like, what, well, you know, you're reading these issues to be like, oh, cool, like, who's the next character, how are they going to reintroduce this lore. Bruce decides, you know what, I need to create a villain in order to, you know, bring the Ultimates together to prove to the world that this is important. And it's reflective of the, you know, the first run of Avengers, you know, they do fight Hulk, I believe, right, in those classic issues, and he does leave the team pretty early on, if I remember correctly. But you know, he calls up Betty and explains to her what he's done, and she's on a date once again, very early 2000s, with Freddie Prinze Jr. Nobody today would care, but like, he's a big hot property, I guess. They're all these, I love how all these like superheroes are just like dating Hollywood celebrities. But anyway, he turns into the Hulk and has this great line. Probably one of the most like memorable lines of this series is that, you know, he hulks out, breaks out of this ambulance and says, "Hulk want Freddie Prinze Jr." and he's going to say some other crazy stuff, I think, in the next issue. So,
oh, yeah.
Once again, we get that cinematic Brian Hitch art. They're all dressing up, gearing up. And we leave this issue with, quote unquote, the Ultimates assembled, or united, or unified. What would the Ultimates say? I have no idea. Probably not assembled, I assume.
Yeah, they don't seem very assembled, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, now we're ready for Hulk Does Manhattan, the final issue in this sort of like mini arc. But yeah, you, man, this like this opening page with the giant man helicopters is pretty funny looking.
Yeah, I don't understand this design at all. Like, you're just like, I'm gonna grow big, and then you're gonna fly me there. Like, can't you just grow? I guess can't you just grow right. big once you get there?
Yeah, seems like
a Hulk for some reason.
They haven't got the logistics figured out. But you know, Hitch's art like really shines in this issue too. I mean, it's shining constantly, but the Hulk, like the two-page Hulk spread where he's just yelling Betty is terrifying. Like, I think he's, you know, other than that, you know, the recent Immortal Hulk, like, I don't think anyone's ever drawn Hulk as this scary. Though Millar did, you know, the Wolverine Hulk stuff. I can't remember the artist behind that. I'm blanking.
I think Romita Jr. did some of the stuff with him on that. If I remember on, correctly.
Old Man Logan?
Oh, on Old Man Logan. That was...
Yeah.
Give me 2 seconds.
Was that Millar? I thought that was Millar, but maybe Millar not.
Who wrote it, yeah. He wrote that as well. That was the...
Yeah, it's who... I think it's who did the Civil War art. Sorry, blinking on that. But anyway, there's some grotesque Hulk in this, but this one is just, this is pretty frightening. So he's going after Betty and Freddie Prinze Jr. Says some unfortunate things about being horny. That's probably the other, along with that Freddie Prinze line, that's the other thing that I remember Pete, like sort of being sort of a controversy or maybe, you know, around the time this book came out. I don't, that's probably not the right word, but I remember that being sort of a big deal for whatever reason. Just, I think it was just shocking to read that coming out of the Hulk's mouth and coming out of a Marvel comic book. But Giant Man shows up and sort of with a pretentious attitude, you know, captures the Hulk in his hands, but is sort of out of his league. And so the Hulk crashes through and, man, there's this gnarly panel where they crash to the ground and the Hulk is almost trying to rip his head out or his jaw out of his head. It's just, I can almost feel that, mm-hmm. that pain that's happening. So this is a vicious Hulk. Like, I feel like it's just, they do just a great job of showing the violence and the scary, like why the Hulk is a threat.
Oh, yeah, Steve McNiven was who we were trying to think of.
Earlier. Oh, that's right. Yes, yeah.
But, yeah, I remember when this issue five was actually, like, I think the first issue of the Ultimates actually obtained and read when it was all coming out. And this was my favorite thing I had read for a while. It's just
that's awesome
version of Hulk. It was just so vicious and crazy. Like, I mean, Pym points it out perfectly. As soon as they get there, like, just the amount of damage Hulk does by being Hulk in the first 10 minutes of the battle is pretty nuts. And then, like, yeah, he goes right at the head of Pym, and, like, I could just hear Homer Simpson yell, "Diddle plan! Lisa needs braces." And Hulk is, like, in his mouth. And I also just love the amount of inexperience they show here. Like, I know that probably makes a couple of them look like chumps, but, like, Pym and Tony Stark, they don't last, like, maybe more than a couple minutes here. Like, Pym gets taken out instantly, pretty much. Like, he almost loses his whole teeth, jawline stuff. And then Iron Man, he doesn't stand a chance. He immediately gets his helmet ripped off. So pretty much it's down to Wasp with no top on and Captain America.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the other thing I remember about this book is she does... hey, Banner, check out these, or like, oh, here it is, Betsy Ross got a rack as nice as these. And then the way that Hitch draws Hulk is just hilarious to me. Right, you go from this, like, unstoppable, frightening character, and then you get this goofy, like, drooling imbecile in the next page as he's trying to catch the Wasp. So very problematic probably in some ways, but I love the way that he's able to capture those, the id, or, you know, the Freudian thoughts that are going through the Hulk's brain. I think he does an amazing job with those illustrations. But he's not able to catch the Wasp, because Captain America decides to drop a tank on the Hulk. And, of course, the Hulk breaks through that, and they have a battle. So Captain America is really the only person to go toe-to-toe with Bruce. You know, he's trying to inject him with a serum to de-Hulkify him, but he's unable to do that. And so there's just this amazing battle, and then somebody finally shows up.
Yep, they get that awesome lightning bolt scene where you just see the Empire State Building, and then there's, like, that big bolt of lightning indicating that Thor is here. And, yeah, he just smashes the Hulk on the top of the head with it and Yeah, this is probably the big turning point in the fight where, like, okay, now they got some actual muscle on their side.
Yeah, and Hulk, or I'm sorry, Thor does some, like, just intense damage. Like, he's just wailing on Hulk in the head, and you can kind of see just the aftermath or the aftershock of each of those blows happening throughout these panels. But Hulk just thinks it tickles and it makes him, quote unquote, more horny for Betsy, which is like, geez, dude, like, I don't, it's just a funny, funny take on the Hulk. You know, so that's Iron Man shows back up, I think, in a repaired suit or a new suit. So it's just, you know, Hulk fighting Captain America, Iron Man, and Thor. But he says Betty. And once again, this is where, yeah, it's just, this is what I love about this Hulk character. And I remember when I was rereading this again, like, he starts chasing after Betty. And, you know, the hitch art really shows the emotion. And he screams out, you know, don't leave Banner alone again. Like, that is such a cool, like, it just shows that insane insecurity that Bruce Banner has and, like, the emotions that play out in the Hulk. I think it's just, it's so well written. It's so well actualized. You know, I kind of like that's my favorite part, I think, of these first five issues, is the way that they characterize the Hulk and the way that his emotions really get to him. And just the, you know, the insecurity that Hulk feels, you know, even as he's, like, tearing these people apart.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, like I said, this is my favorite issue of the whole thing. And you get to see Banner bottle up all this emotion for the first three issues he's in. Obviously, he's not in the first issue, but yeah, it just all comes from, as soon as he hears the name Freddie Prinze Jr. associated with Betty Ross, that was the turning point of all things. So somehow here, yeah, Freddie Prinze survives the Hulk, but it seems like he's cheating on Sarah Michelle Gellar, so I'm not sure if he's going to survive Buffy or not.
I don't blame him. There was a Buffy poster a couple issues back in Bruce Banner's apartment. So once again, coming full circle. And speaking of holes and circles, Wasp is in one. Inside of Bruce's head, brain, so she's able to get to some type of nerve center and zap him out of Hulk mode. And you know, this is, I feel like, in previously when the Hulk is chasing down Betty in the helicopter, I think that's definitely what influenced, like, the Hulk movie that came out after Iron Man. There's a very much similar scene in that movie too. So you see again this comic, you know, really influencing that MCU. So Bruce falls down, you know, off the helicopter. He's turned back to his normal self. You know, and this is, like, an interesting turn for Captain America's character too, right? Like, this is where I think you've seen at this point Captain America pretty much be one-to-one, you know, in terms of who he is as a hero. But, you know, Bruce is sort of apologizing and Captain is, you know, saying, like, don't be ridiculous. You know, I wouldn't hit you, Bruce. You know, you're just part of the team. And then what does he do?
He puts that gash on his cheek. Which,
yeah.
At the end of the day, I mean, I think this is, obviously it's Hulk's comic, but I think, you know, Captain America is the other star of this one. Like, it's his chess game that they're playing mm-hmm. here. Really, like, if Captain America was not here, New York would be completely leveled at this point. They would have been just screwed. So, luckily, Cap had, like, five strategies lined up to beat the Hulk, and, you know, the one with Wasp in the eardrum actually succeeded. So, but, yeah, like, by the time you see this goofy Bruce Banner in the middle of this rubble get up, like, obviously, like, this is Captain America's home that just got messed up. It's still his home, whether he likes it or not. And I think he realizes that. And, you know, he gave Bruce Banner a nice kick in the face. And I think he felt good about it.
A nice kick, kiss of the boot there, which I don't think regular Captain America would have done, like, in Marvel 616. I think like that's to me like a little sort of reveal of like the sort of the, like I said earlier, I think all these characters are sort of jerks.
And, yeah, he does get to throw him out of a plane later in one of the best scenes in the whole series, so I can't wait for that. So that's just another example of how fun Captain America gets.
Yeah, but that, and then that ends it. that kick in the face ends that issue. And, you know, I would love to say brighter days are ahead for this team, but unfortunately, I think like that's not going to be the case. So, yeah, that's the first five issues of Ultimates. This first volume, Carson, like you said, 13 issues. So we'll get to those. I think we'll be able to, I don't know if we'll be able to knock them all out next time, but you know, we'll get pretty close. I, you know, we had to spend a lot of time sort of ramping up here initially. Cause I, you know, I think it's interesting to think about, you know, where the Ultimates were in terms of the comics, you know, the Ultimate Comics line, you know, they came later. I almost thought, oh, this came out right at the same time as X-Men and Spider-Man. I didn't realize how much later, quote unquote, later it came out, but they had to do sort of some world building. So it makes sense. But, yeah, that last issue kind of, even rereading it again, even though I had just read it like a week ago. Yeah, it is. That last issue is pretty damn good.
Oh yeah. Like I said, I'm kind of glad I ended up reading that first. Then I went back and got the other ones in a row. If I was trying to like read the, like maybe issues 2, 3, and 4 month to month, it would have maybe been a little bit too slow of a build for me, which even reading it now, like I said, the build is, it's a long build toward issue 5. It really is. But yeah, then once you get to like Brian Hitch drawing that awesome action, it's Ultimates at its best.
Yeah. It's a good payoff. So that'll do it here for our part one on the Ultimates. Carson, where can people find you?
Oh man, if you search CWoodard19 on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, you can find me on all those avenues. I actually just put up a live stream on my channel, youtube.com/CWoodard19, yesterday, where I showed off some original art I've acquired recently. So if you like original art, go ahead and check out that live stream. Let me know what you think. Also, I'm over on the Comic Core YouTube channel. We just recorded Modern Men last Monday, where we talked about Thanos and the Infinity Gauntlet. We had a heck of a show there. And next Monday, we're going to talk about Ninja Turtles. So we're going to review the IDW Ninja Turtles Volume 1 and dedicate the whole show just talking about how much we like Ninja Turtles, basically.
Awesome. Cowabunga, as I should say. You interviewed Eastman again.
Yeah, that's right. I did.
Yeah.
So I'll probably be dropping that interview on my channel as well, but it's currently located, I believe, on the mainframecomiccon.com and that YouTube channel that they have going on over there. So you can check out the Kevin Eastman interview as well as, I don't know if they've posted the Sophie Campbell one individually yet. She is the current writer/artist of Post-100 Ninja Turtles. If not, I'll be having that on my channel soon as well. But yeah, absolutely amazing experience getting the chance to talk to Kevin Eastman for a second time.
Yeah, you guys are becoming buddies. My hope is that I can piggyback off that. And if somehow comic conventions happen again and he comes to Chicago, we can get beers. That would be amazing. So he seems like such a nice, cool dude,
he's been
too.
Great stuff. But yeah, I've got a chance to do 2 half-hour interviews with him, and both times he has been awesome.
Love it. That's awesome. Looking forward to checking out some of the stuff that you've done. People can find me at Raptors Revenge. So on all the socials. So check that stuff out. If you got a chance, stop by, say hi. I hope everyone out there is still enjoying the series. I know this one was a long one, but you know, looking forward to getting back into volume, or at least not volume two. There isn't a volume two, but part two here next time. So we will catch you later.
Later.